Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1158.DE0413, certificate number 51403, the Sight and Sound Pole.
I don't think any word can explain a man's life. No, I guess Rosebud is just a piece in a jigsaw puzzle. A missing piece.
Now, in any of your various roles, John, as a cultural commentator or a performer or a local expert, whatever.
Sex advice columnist.
Eminence Grease.
Basketball trick shooter.
Oh, I thought you were going to say color commentary. Yeah, basketball trick shooter.
Basketball waxer.
Have you ever been asked to provide a top 10 list any kind?
Yes, all the time.
Is that right?
Yes.
Like end of year kind of stuff?
Absolutely.
What are some examples and what do you think about this whole ritual?
Well, it still happens now, except now people want my playlists. Mm. But back in the 2000s and 2010s, yeah, it's a common way of trying to interact with a musician or somebody that you want to talk to or admire.
Oh, this is just fan correspondence? No, nobody wants to publish it?
It ends up being reporters who are trying to fill column inches and they're thinking, what should I do? Oh, I should ask 10 indie rock artists to name their top 10 either records of the year or top 10 most influential records on them or et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's always a tag, a hook. And I'm terrible at making top 10 lists.
I assumed you would not be enthusiastic about it at a bare minimum. We know from the book and the movie High Fidelity that there is this in a lot of these fandom circles. There's a lot of this culture of let's do this as a parlor game. What are your top five, this top 10 songs that have whistling, top 10 albums of the 80s, whatever.
We used to play the game on tour. We would take turns DJing in the van on the many, many long hours across the world. That's how you travel around the world, across it.
You're right. Don't go through it.
No.
It's too hot.
You go across the world, but each of us would take, you know, the early days of having an iPod and compose a playlist as you went with a theme, right? Oh, I'm going to do, let's see. And, you know, and try and guess the theme. But it's a fun discipline to sit and say, oh, I'm going to do all songs that are in the third person or all songs that are about.
It's a new axis to think about art on.
Yeah. But I'm not good at it. I guess I can get into it.
Well, you're not a fanish person in general. You I think you have some built-in scorn at kind of identifying yourself with the things you like. And so the glee that people take in fighting over whether something is the eighth or ninth best, whatever, seems like you would actively poo-poo it.
Yeah, I do.
Am I right? Go ahead and poo-poo it.
Poo. I mean, this was all, there are so many versions of this. There are the people that will sit for hours and argue about how they organize their vinyl. Like,
that's also a high fidelity plot point.
Yeah. How is it organized? And I was just like, there, I couldn't, first of all, it's not, my vinyl isn't organized at all. It all goes in just like, wee. But second, well, who cares? But there are also people that have, their bookshelf is arranged by color, you know, or those people, do you remember where people were putting their books in, spine in?
Yeah. I know somebody who does this.
And you know, it's cute. Alarming. And stuff, but it has nothing to do with books. Anyway, you're right. It's the lack of fan. I don't have that impulse. And so whenever I would get asked, can you do this? I would always decline. And then I would have my publicist or other publicists say, you know, it's just an opportunity to get your name in a magazine.
Right.
Don't decline. It's not some dignity issue. Just make up a thing.
But they are trying to get you to write their thing for free.
Right.
Here, I don't want to write a listicle. You write a listicle. I will still get paid for the listicle.
And the thing is, I'm happy to write 1,000 words for them, but just not, don't make me do that dumb thing.
But is any of it on a basis of like, oh, it's like picking my children. I couldn't possibly, or is this just like my brain doesn't work this way?
No,
or,
I have zero.
I think a lot of it is that you take no pleasure from it. And these people, the world is full of people who take a specific, and I am very far over on the other end of the spectrum, take a certain kind of nerdy completist's pleasure. It's you know, it's like a warm bath to be like, ah, you know, what were the best, you know, if I did have to order the Beatles albums by quality of first song, right, or if I, you know, what are the best movies that change from black and white to color halfway through? Oh boy, you know, like what a thrill. And you are maybe lucky to be missing the gene of just enjoying swimming and stuff like that.
Every once in a while, I'll get a wild hair. I did it the other day where I was like, you know what? The rock music of the 1980s owes a lot to the band Foreigner. And we never talk about Foreigner for, you know, and I'm not going to argue.
We on Omnibus? Or?
Well, anybody. I mean, the rock music.
I think critic, we should talk more about Foreigner.
Yeah, the critical consensus does almost never include Foreigner. But you cannot have really any of the I don't know, sort of boomer, middle-aged guy rock, you know, muscular-sounding keyboard rock of 1985 without listening to Foreigner 4 from 1981 and seeing that the first four Foreigner records have all the DNA of everything that came after until Metallica's first record, which has nothing to do with Foreigner and takes nothing from it. But, you know, Foreigner...
They did it.
Foreigner plays this incredible, this influential role in the sound and vibe of the sort of Eddie Money mainstream and actually Bruce Springsteen and John Cougar, all that stuff, you know, because Foreigner was British, but they're making this real kind of American guitar, but not...
Hence the name.
It's not... Right. The guitar isn't going to hurt your feelings, but it's tough enough that, you know, that you can wear blue jeans and feel good about it. So I will do that every once in a while. Like, I've got a thesis.
But that's very much like, I've got a controversial, possibly inflammatory historical appreciation here. And it might be about rock or it might be about the Kaiser, right?
Yeah, that's right. And the thing is, I'm not invested in Foreigner 4.
No.
I'm not trying to argue that I, you know.
And on some level, you might like the contrarianist nature of the position.
Or just, this isn't something that we've been thinking about. Why don't we think about this for a second?
But this to me is something a little bit different, which is a different kind of phase that we've moved into in terms of critical discourse and consensus, which is, let's see your lists. Let's see everybody's preferences. Oh, let's fight over the... And
that phrase, let's see your lists. I've actually heard that.
Like, and you're a person without a list.
Yeah, I don't have one.
I have a hard time assembling a list. I always feel like I have
so many lists.
Well, no, it's just more like there's some level of, well, I'm going to leave stuff off of the list, but it's also like, do I trust myself? Does this movie that I saw that really impressed me the first time I saw it, is that as good as a movie that the fourth time really reveals itself? The same thing for the song that's a slow burner or a grower.
What is your top French new wave film?
Exactly.
Name it.
Last Year at Marienbad.
Okay.
But see, you know, you but on a different day, I might say Breathless. You know, I might have different answers.
We're going to get letters
in French. But yeah, there's people who would not even have to think because the part of their brand is just, I know what my favorite movie of 1987 was. And
what's your favorite movie of 1987?
You know, the funny thing is, one of my stories when I was on Jeopardy for the first time was that I had a webpage where I listed my 2000 favorite movies in order. And it was kind of true because I was going through by year. And I was saying, have I seen 10 movies from 1931? Hey, I have.
Wow.
Let's put them in order. And so cool. I had, you know, and this is something we do in real time, like, you know, not we, not you, but, you know, a dedicated moviegoer would at the end of the year think back, like, what were my favorite movies of 2022? Did I like Top Gun Maverick more than I liked Tar or Everything Everywhere All at Once? Or you would never think this way.
No, it's a completely foreign impulse to me. And you can see in my face, I'm like, why would you?
But some people, and there's really nothing about the art that requires it. Obviously, the year boundaries are completely arbitrary, but something about that kind of rigor and just a chance to revisit the past and reassess our opinions appeals to us for some reason.
Did you know I've been to Marion Bad?
Last year?
No.
Yeah, I think I met you there last year, or was it the year before?
No, it was neither of those times. It was several years ago on a little trip I took.
So the
across the world.
You did not bore through Europe like the mole man.
It's the Czech name is Marianský Lázně, and I don't know if that appears in the film because I've never seen it.
The film is kind of it's a version of an avant-garde French novel in which a nameless pair of people meet at this resort, and one is convinced they've met before and the other is convinced they haven't.
Oh.
And really it turns out not to matter because this is not a traditional plot or
psychologie
development. Yes, exactly.
Marianský Lázně is a beautiful spa and a strange, very strange place.
I want to visit it because the movie and the book are famously kind of strange and beautiful and unearthly. And I wonder if that's inspired by the real place or if it's just, I always just assumed it was some arbitrary, because I think in the movie, it's just kind of used as a placeholder. Like, was it Marienbad or was it Friedrichsbad or?
Yeah, there are two big spa towns, over in Western Czech Republic, and Marianský Lázně is the smaller of the two.
I don't think I could have even told you that it's in modern Czech Republic boundaries.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's in Western Czech Republic, which was the Sudetenland, which was formerly populated largely by Germans, which is why it's called Marienbad.
I don't think you should really be supporting that claim.
You know what?
It hasn't aged well to say that the Germans should move into their ancestral Sudetenland.
No, I don't believe they should, but I do think it's not contestable that it was a lot of Germans living there.
It's been known to happen.
Yeah. I don't want to. I'm not like some kind of revisionist.
But as a result of, you know, having this kind of list, I had put it on kind of a rudimentary GeoCities type website. And when I was struggling for something interesting to say about myself to Alex Trebek, I was like, oh, I'll be a movie nerd today. And people were like, I want to see Ken. Suddenly, you know, I'm getting emails every day. Hey, where's that page that had your list of all your 2000 favorite movies organized by year?
Yeah, on your 70th show, I imagine you and Alex had really run out of anecdotes.
On my 7th show, I'd run out of anecdotes. It was a pretty bleak scene. You've heard this show.
Yeah. Well, what you started to do was just write your name in, like, with weird art, and that was something to talk about,
He would usually just go off card. He'd be like, Ken, I want to ask you something. And he looks at the 5 boring stories on my card and looks up and says, what are your, you know...
You ever seen a grown man naked?
Do you like Roman gladiator movies? So I am very much on the other end of the spectrum where I'm, you know, I have this urge to, you know, the enjoyment of cataloging favorites of various kinds and genres is like very real to me on it, but I really can't defend it. But
you've really tempered that in your and my relationship. It almost never comes up that you like start fanboying out and then check yourself. Like, you know that you're not going to get that from me, so you never bring it up.
I feel like it's a private pursuit. Like, if I'm with somebody else who enjoys it, then it can become a social pursuit. Like if you wanted to argue with me about Godard and Truffaut, you know, hey, that's fun.
I don't.
But clearly you don't, and you give that off. You emanate, do not ask me to rate the Radiohead albums in order, you know? Because people will, and it'll
wait,
be...
Wait, they had more than one album?
What? Now I have a tie at 4th place, and this is going to be controversial. There's a million podcasts that do this.
Yeah, sure.
But of all the things that I kind of hate about modern criticism, this is one that I feel is...
Can you make a list of the top 10 things you hate about modern criticism?
Number 10. I feel like maybe this show will become that at some point. Because I have, you know, I feel like the ways that we interact with art are deeply broken in the social media era.
Yes.
But this one to me seems pretty benign. This thing that happens every December where people start to argue about their favorite records and the critics polls come out and then the readers poll comes out and we argue about whether the critics are out of touch or the readers are too dumb or...
Paz and Jop.
Paz and Jop. So since you mentioned Paz and Jop, the Village Voice has been doing this influential... Is it critics poll or readers poll? It's critics, right? No, maybe it's readers.
It's critics, but for a long time... Oh, this is embarrassing. For a long time, I was one of the contributors to the Paz and Jop readers poll.
See, why didn't you lead with this?
Well, because I never knew what to do. And they would send out this exhaustive list of everything that had come out.
They sent out a list.
Oh, huge list of like, and you need to pick, you need to rank the things that you loved and all these different lists. You know, what was your favorite jazz album? What was your favorite? And I was so overwhelmed by it. I would sit and look at this list for a long time because I was on the Grammy board too, voting for the Grammy Awards. Same thing, exhaustive list of everything.
Do the Grammys send out screeners like the Oscars do, so you can listen to stuff for free?
Well, and because I wrote a column for the Seattle Weekly that was in the music section,
you'd get review copies.
I was on this list where I would get 50 CDs a week, and all these emails begging me to review the latest, you know, My Sister's Machine record or whatever. No, that never happened. But I felt so much, I don't know, not pressure exactly, but just like, it was like people were haranguing me in a foreign language.
The world is demanding my list.
I was sitting in a cafe in Morocco and somebody was yelling at me and I was like, I have no idea what you're saying. I don't know. I've only heard one Silver Sun pickup song. I cannot tell you whether that record is better than the In Spiral Carpets record.
What does better even mean?
What are you talking about?
The Paz and Jop poll's Robert Christgau's Village Voice poll that he started in 1970.
But it's hugely influential. We were on it at one point in some way, way down it.
But there was a sales bump?
Well, never a sales bump. Even if
you're like, Lord, no.
Even if you're on the Letterman show, you don't sell any more records. But, you know, there were high fives happening.
Yeah.
And I still hear all the time, like, oh, remember when A.C. Newman was number 40 on the Paz and Jop? And I'm like,
this
no.
is increasingly where enthusiasm for art happens. This is now the forum for how we celebrate art, because this kind of is the communal space to be like, ooh, look what's up six places in the poll this year. And this is a new phenomenon. The idea of a top 10 list is quite new. I spent some time this morning going through like 19th century literary corpuses to see if you can find anybody talking about their 10 favorite anything.
Is it a Wolfman Jack thing? Where did it start? Casey Kasem?
I mean, I guess it starts on Mount Sinai.
Oh, sure.
I mean...
Wait, were there like 11 through 15 and we just don't know about them?
Yeah, there's a tie. At 11 through 13, there's a tie, three other commandments that were cut off the list. No, I mean, 10 is obviously an obvious number for this kind of list dating back to the Decalogue and probably has something to do with our evolutionary fingers.
We got those fingers.
It's the fingers. But the idea that you would assemble your 10 favorite things and then argue about it with other composers, poets, writers, whatever.
Prophets.
Seems to be quite new. I mean, the model we had in the 18th and 19th centuries was more of a, it's today's county fair. There's a small room full of experts or judges, and they're going to put their heads together, and then they're going to come out with a medal and stick it on the best pig.
Who made the,
or the best preserves.
The best jam, yeah.
And this is basically the model that the Pulitzers have used since 1917, that the Nobel Prizes have used since 1901, the Cannes Film Festival since 1946. A small group of prestigious people, like, ooh, look who's on the jury this year, decide, and there's no pretense that it's some consensus choice, because it's by definition a small group, and we know on some level that there was going to be infighting and deal making in that room.
But there's no second place in the Nobels or the Pulitzers, right?
And those are not, yeah, so you're right, those are not top 10 lists. A single ribbon has been awarded by a group of experts, so there was not a big, hey, the sample's better the more critics we get, and there's no, you know what's fun if we can rank these and see the runners up and fight about them. This system is, you know, it goes back at least to the Paris Salon, the famous art show in 1748. That show first had a jury that got together and said, here's the one winner. But if you want somebody making a list of their 10 favorite things, I can find the poet Charles A. Dana doing it shortly before his death in the 1890s, saying, you know, just an article where he was like, as an interesting exercise, I considered the 10 short poems that every schoolboy should know, you know, and then he's like, it's Shakespeare's sonnet, this, it's Milton's sonnet, this, it's, right. And because it's the 1890s, he ends with Tennyson and Kipling.
It's the Harvard 10-foot shelf of books idea of what constitutes a corpus or a
canon.
Yeah, a canon.
And that's an interesting idea when it comes to some of the other art forms we'll look at here. And I think that's the idea. That's about the time this idea is getting built that, you know, this is what the educated man, we would have said, because right. It was an awful patriarchy, would have on his shelf.
Well, it was a patriarchy. Let's not just go ahead and say it was awful.
Oh, it was pretty awful.
It was, you know,
you think it was
good
fine?
And bad. What are the
top 10 patriarchies?
Patriarchies. Top 10 things about any patriarchy.
Right,
but you always start with the Greeks.
Yeah.
Or, I mean,
It's true that once you assemble a literary canon, you're well on your way to saying, what are the top 100 great books?
Right.
You know, you're not there yet, and you're not doing it you wouldn't say it's fun.
You're not doing it in that voice. You're not radio DJ voice.
Well, yeah, so radio DJs are a big part of what we think of as a top 10 countdown, because Gen X came up with Casey Kasem and Shadow Stevens doing this on the radio. But in fact, you know, Billboard's charts are never a top 10. You know, Billboard had a Hot 100 starting in the 50s. They had a top... Their radio show that Casey Kasem started was top 40.
Top 40.
Billboard's number is generally 40 and 100. And there is a predecessor. They did have... The very earliest Billboard lists are, I think, just for reasons of easier computation, these are the 10 top-selling sheet music things. And this kind of comes out of this, the turn of the century era. There's just an explosion of it. And I don't think we can blame Charles Dana or anybody else, but suddenly Harper's and the Saturday Review are going to have like, boy, what are last year's 10 best novels? We spoke to Professor whatever at Yale and Professor somebody else at Northwestern. And here's what they said. You start to see more of these at the end of the year.
So it's an end of the year wrap up. Is where it kind of starts.
I mean, not Charles Dana. Charles Dana's doing some best poems all time. And maybe right. Some of these articles...
Because he's on his deathbed.
He doesn't have time to look at last... He didn't read all of his manuscripts that he got. He didn't watch all his screeners from last year. But a lot of these things showing up in the Saturday Evening Post are just more like, these experts, you know, the same reason BuzzFeed does listicles. These experts say, these are the 10 paintings. What do you think, reader? You know, because they realize they're going to inspire lively discussion in a parlor or around a Cracker Barrel somewhere. The FBI has a top 10 list as of 1949.
Oh, that I would have thought that was Public Enemy number one was 20 years before that.
I think the 10 most wanted list. I mean, maybe there is Public Enemy. I think you're right. I think Dillinger is Public Enemy number one. But just as with...
There's not a Public Enemy number seven.
Just as with the Nobel Prizes begetting, you know, these 10 best lists... the idea that the public would react to a top 10 and that would be something you could follow and, you know, track criminals out the same way you're tracking pop signals, that's a late 40s invention.
And that was big when we were kids. The 10 most wanted list.
You couldn't go to the post office without thinking about it.
But I guess now it's not such a big deal.
I don't even know. Do they even have it? Somebody will tell us. I don't care enough to look.
People get caught so fast now because... It's like, well, we got videotape of this guy.
They're gummies.
We got his license plate number two.
Literally in the YouTube video, you could see his phone number. And then Letterman in 1985. You know, by that time, it's become enough of a staple of our conversation that you can have an ironic take on it. Like the very first top 10 list has no jokes in it.
The Letterman one,
yeah. He just says, here are 10, with much fanfare, and drum rolling, it's here are 10 words that kind of sound like peas, or 10 words that almost rhyme with peas. And then he just says, meat. And there's kind of a, you know, Paul does a thing, and there's kind of a muffled laugh as people gradually figure out what's happening.
Yeah.
But it's a take on the idea that with much aplomb, you would count down to the best of something. the Casey Kasem model.
The word that most closely sounds.
Here's our number one word that almost rhymes with peas. But, you know, more than any, you know, and we've covered Paz and Jop, and we've covered, you know, so there's been music and art and literature, jazz, Downbeat magazine starts asking critics and readers for the best jazz records in the 50s. It's happening everywhere, but nowhere more so than in the movies.
Oh.
For whatever reason, and I would, if I was just talking out of my butt, as I am, I would say that it's some overlap of a big, well-moneyed industry, with a you know, savvy promotional wing, plus the egos of these people that lead to lots of self-congratulatory honors and award ceremonies, plus the fact that they're actually, it's a new medium, so there is a lot of artistic innovation going on, plus it's got mass popularity. Everybody has an opinion. So you combine all these things, it's a perfect storm for where the top 10 list kind of appears.
It was the first art form that really was, you were talking about big money,
right?
Too, right? Like you could be a million seller with your Bebop-a-Lula 7-inch, but it's not like the big dollars that Ben-Hur brought in. And so the top 10, you're also, it's the first time you're able to say like, this earned $100 million. That's in itself exciting.
Yeah, it is. And it's, you know, everybody young and old will have seen Ben-Hur or Broken Blossoms or whatever the big silent movie of 1920, whatever is. It's both art and it's the opiate of the masses.
Yeah.
And so, you know, famously, the Oscars are an industry vote. Thousands of insiders are voting. But we get into top 10 polls pretty quickly. The National Board of Review is a group that started out as a censorship board, as you can, as implied by their name. But that kind of morphed into like, we provide a seal of artistic merit. Mm-hmm. You know, like, what are the uplifting movies that your community should be should be showing in its movie houses? And as an arm of this, in 1929, they produced a top 10 list. Like, here are the top 10 most gratifying and enriching films of 1929.
No sexual innuendo, no strong female leads.
Exactly. Awful patriarchy at every turn. But it was, I think at this point, it was less like Catholic bishops and just a bunch of what it is today, New York City area film enthusiasts who are like,
oh, so they were actually
the good movies.
Not just looking for clean movies, but really.
Yeah, these are the movies of merit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like your women's group should have seen Hallelujah, King Vidor's best.
Oh, so film already had the imprimatur of high culture?
It did.
Oh.
It did. I think just because it was so obvious when somebody tried something, like there's so much of this dreck with Keystone Cops falling down, but have you guys seen Ernst Lubitsch's The Love Parade? It's a uplifting romance at par with any sonnet, you know, that this kind of thing. And the National Board of Review, you may or may not be aware, still exists today.
Yes.
And a bunch of film enthusiasts still turn out a top, and they do so in December. They turn out a top 10 list before the award season really kicks off.
Do they do it with the award season in mind, hoping to influence it?
Yeah, I think it's the same kind of thing with the Iowa caucus, where every year the Golden Globes are jockeying with the New York film critics, you know, because you don't want to be too late and irrelevant, but also if the race shapes up late, you don't want to be the ones who are like, National Board of Review, because it's, I think, a small group of critics, is kind of hilariously out of step with what becomes the consensus. I was looking at their recent picks, and they agree with the Oscar Best Picture almost never. Like, wow. Once every decade, it'll happen to intersect, and it won't be some predictable masterpiece. It'll just be like, yeah, they both liked Slumdog Millionaire, I guess. Yeah, they couldn't say no to Green Book.
Uh-huh.
You know, but the rest of the time, I think this year the National Board of Review said Top Gun Maverick. You know, they were...
Did they really?
They were populist this year. But then last year it was Licorice Pizza, a movie that generated a lot more think pieces than ticket sales or awards.
I heartily agree, because Licorice Pizza basically illustrated my childhood, or rather 2 years earlier than my childhood.
I mean,
it really resonated.
The waterbeds resonated. The age gap I could not overlook. I think you.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I do not buy that she would be interested in this high school boy. It seems like a high school boy's fantasy.
Yes.
That an interesting 20 something would want to date him.
But you will notice in the oeuvre of that particular writer director, there's an awful lot of that.
I haven't thought about that.
Precocious.
Am I going to have to go back and look at the Paul Thomas Anderson age gaps? Around the same time, Variety starts doing a critics poll. The National Board of Review does. And so, you know, more than anybody else, the movie industry is creating this thing where at the end of every year, there's a series of banquets and a series of lists that get published where critics and readers alike kind of jockey over what the best of the year was, as if that's a meaningful way to think about art. Because, you know, it's if you don't work in an industry, it is weird to be like, well, the thing about the films of 88, but now we're totally, this is baked into our culture. You know, even a kind of a layperson will know that 1939 was some famously great year. And, you know, what are the years that were weak? And finally, we arrive at 1952.
Yay!
When this story will begin and end in Belgium, like all good stories do. The Festival Mondial du Film et des Beaux-Arts de Belgique, the Belgian Film and Fine Arts Festival, decides on a project. The movies are now 50 years old, they say, which is a little bit iffy. But yeah, basically, there's been half a century of some kind of attempt to make film. A time to look back and review. And I guess as a hook for their festival, they contact 100 big names in the film industry, directors and producers and so on, and ask them, hey, what do you think the 10 best films of film's first half century have been?
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Brussels Referendum, in hindsight. And they emphasize that, look, we're just asking for your personal preference. What is your feeling about this, John Ford or René Clair or whatever? Like, you don't have to be delivering us any kind of attempt at a objective, academically important, historically important elite. Just what are your 10? Even back then, they're like, it's a little bit striking. What are your 10 films that make you happy and feel good? You know, this should be particular to you. And mostly what they get back is complaints. A bunch of people send refusals. Charlie Chaplin, Eric von Stroheim, René Clair, Jean Cocteau, Alfred Hitchcock, Laurence Olivier, all people who are like, not going to play this game.
Okay. My people.
Yeah. And I'm for some reason, I'm sure many of these names are kind of hoity-toity, and you would think to yourself that they object to the art being dragged through the...
Yeah, it's not a sport.
It's not a competition. Exactly.
Yeah.
And to this day, you'll hear this with the Oscars. Like, it makes no sense to say, did this guy play an elderly African-American garbage man as well as this young guy played a hot white werewolf? You know, it's... How are we even pretending this is a thing?
Francis McDormand.
But there's something
wins
fun
it
about
all.
It. Francis McDormand every year. But they do get enough people, and they get a lot of people just complaining about having to do it. You know, what a difficult choice it is, you know, choosing my children, etc. But they get dozens of ballots back, and because a lot of them are from name people, it becomes kind of, they publish some of them, but it becomes interesting. You know, they're like, who would have thought that, you know, Carl Dreyer, who produces these kind of dour, Lutheran, somber mood pieces, loves The Petrified Forest, an early gangster movie with, you know, the movie that kind of broke Humphrey Bogart. So there's these kind of fun discoveries like this. Another thing they find is that lots of people are voting for themselves, which is so bizarre to me. And I think today you would not see it.
No.
It would really take a gutsy person to be like, I know this is going to be published, but, you know, I, Paul Thomas Anderson, think that There Will Be Blood is the best movie of the 90s.
You know, every once in a while, you do get 2000s. A celebrity that where their brand is that they're just unapologetically like, I am the greatest.
It's the post-Muhammad Ali era.
But it's so rare, and you can only get away with it if you are the right kind of flamboyant, which almost no one is.
I think because it's a list of 10... then at least you can make your movie one of them.
Yeah, right.
Your humble author cannot help but add that in the number 10 spot, I have placed my own. So I guess, you know, to a man, a lot of the big names make number 10 is one of their own movies. Or at least one they, you know, I think they say that Billy Wilder offers Ninotchka, which is a movie he wrote but did not direct. So it's some kind of humble brag, you know.
If you ran for office, would you vote for yourself or would you sportingly vote for your opponent?
I feel like that's a little bit different.
It's secret, for one.
That's the main difference. And also, it's such a large sample size that you know you're unlikely to swing it. You know?
But you also,
it's a symbolic vote either way.
I remember when I ran for office, sitting and looking at my ballot and saying, well, you know, I want to be a sporting person and give my charitable yay to my opponent. But do I not think I'm the best candidate?
That's what always made me think it was the silliest possible vote. Like, if you don't have your own vote, who is going to vote for
exactly.
you?
Exactly. Like, I do believe I would be the best in this job. Why would I throw my vote away?
And did you vote for John, what's his name?
I'll never say. Oh, no,
Grant.
I didn't vote for that guy. No.
I was trying to think. What is that guy's name?
John Grant. He was not the best candidate.
But who cares?
Of the three of us.
It would be the most sporting to vote for it would be the most selfless to vote for your... your last pick.
No, I would still be sitting chewing on gristle if I'd done that.
So this is a big deal. For the first time, they can print a top 10 list, a direct, they have enough people that they can say, this is a consensus of the world's great directors.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, it is, let's see.
Go on.
A lot of silent movies, a lot of movies that now seem a little bit dated to us. The consensus, the winner, they just printed top 10, and the winner is the Soviet director Sergei Eisenstein's silent movie Potemkin, about the...
Sure, we watched it on my late lamented podcast.
Oh, right, it's a war
Friendly
film.
Fire, yeah.
And it's got the, it, you know, for a movie of that era, it does hold up very well, because he basically invented modern editing. It's got the baby carriage going down the steps that Brian De Palma ripped off in Untouchables.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic to watch, to see all the tropes.
Yeah, and you really have to, if you don't know this guy invented this kind of cross-cutting, then you're not going to be, like, moved by it. But right. To me, there's, if you watch enough movies, you do kind of internalize, hey, movies from the 20s don't really look this contemporary. This guy does have something. And so, you know, that's how I still feel when I look at Wells or somebody who is ahead of their time, but it's maybe been dulled by the culture catching up.
Well, I just sat down with my 11 and 10-month-old daughter, and we watched Casablanca.
Interesting.
And
is this because of the conversation we were having at dinner the other night about what one black and white movie would you show? Do you remember we were talking about this?
Yeah, that might have planted it in my head.
Huh. Mindy has a friend who had we were asking about It's a Wonderful Life, and her friend was like, "What? I've never seen a black and white movie."
Yeah, right.
And
right.
Mindy, and so we were like, "Well, what is the black and white movie you show to somebody like this who apparently starts Wizard of Oz with the Munchkins every time?"
And I would not have come to Casablanca on my own, but I was like, "Yeah, what's, you know, it's not going to hurt anybody. It's got Nazis.
It's got romance. It's got action.
Some French.
It's got movie stars who still kind of hold up as movie stars. It's glamorous setting.
I've never been able to understand Humphrey Bogart as a romantic lead.
Big head.
But there you go.
Okay, that's the secret. Head. Short guy, big head. It reads well on screen.
But watching it through her eyes and watching her grapple with, why am I watching this? And, you know, and the fact that I'm like, no. But that's the thing. He never says play it again, Sam. And all, you know, all this stuff. And so I started to do some research on it and learned that Casablanca was not a hit. It did fine in theaters, but it was just a middle of the road film. But it became a movie that played in revival houses. And then what was it that it was like a movie that every year at Yale Homecoming, they played it for 2 weeks at this little theater in New Haven,
right?
As some kind of like, they did it once and then everybody was like, ha ha ha, let's do that again. And for however many years, they just did it every year at Homecoming. And through that, it became like this beloved staple.
That's a real phenomenon that you see when you trace the history of these top 10 polls, is that you have to remember at the very beginning, there is no great books shelf for movies. Not only is there no sense of what the canon is, but also there's no way to watch them. You're thinking back to when this, you know what I loved when it came out in 1931 was this. And so you're not really, nobody's really like, I've seen it on TV a couple times since then. It doesn't really hold up.
When did they start doing repertory theaters or?
Yeah, a lot of movies just kind of caught, a lot of movies that we now think of as classics of that era just kind of caught on over broadcast TV. You know, the networks that would show Wizard of Oz every Thanksgiving. The accident of It's a Wonderful Life falling into the public domain so that TV stations could show it on Christmas. And then a movie that had been a flop became a, you know, maybe the most quoted movie of the century.
Yeah.
And then what gets programmed at film festivals, you know, because a director could be forgotten until one influential screening happens and suddenly the critical establishment is all abuzz. That's kind of what happens here.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You know, the month after this Brussels referendum is reported, Sight and Sound magazine, love to get to the title an hour in.
Sight and Sound, I used to sell it at Steve's Broadway News.
They had it on the newsstand?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, it's very hard to get now.
I'll and it was that. Only nerds that bought it.
I spent, I believe that 100%.
You know, we had like 9 cinemaphile magazines. It was a whole like corner of the store.
I spent a very pleasant weekday this week sitting in the University of Washington Library looking through
old... microfiche nerds.
I did not go to the microfiche because they have bound volumes.
Oh, wow, they do.
Yeah, they had bound volumes of Sight and Sound back to like 1958.
Wow, no kidding.
And so I could go...
Our tax dollars at work.
I could, well, the British tax dollars at work. Plus, yeah, plus one. So Sight and Sound magazine is an arm of the British Film Institute, like a lot of European nations. Great Britain has this... kind of nationalized nonprofit with heavy government ties, currently funded by the National Lottery, mm-hmm. whose aim is to support homegrown film.
It's not paid for by the TV licenses that everybody has to pay.
Even worse, lottery tickets. TV. It's a tax on the dumb. But luckily, it's paid for one of the world's greatest film archive. The U.S. has never really had this because... A, our movies will get watched everywhere no matter how bad they are, even if we don't subsidize it.
God bless America.
And B, we believe in freedom and therefore
barely.
Evil social democracy should not be propping up private industry in this way.
Right. That's right. And especially not snooty East Coast critical darlings.
But in Europe, they have no such problems with this. Like Finland wants to make sure Finnish movies get distributed and made and distributed. And so the BFI is a huge, powerful, I mean, I don't want to say powerful, but it's a prestigious institution that supports scholarship and has a big library and supports British film in general. And at one arm of this is this quarterly review magazine that they started publishing in 1930. And they published a piece called, I think, As You Like It in 1952 about this Brussels referendum. And then the following month, they thought it would, because they are all film academics, they were like, well, what if you weren't asking Orson Welles and Jean Renoir? What if you were asking us, critics? What would we say were the best movies?
Yeah.
Because who would know better than us?
Let's foreground us.
Those who can't do. And so they publish a follow-up thing in the following issue, I think called As the Critics Like It. And it's not a cover package. You know, it was very fun, by the way, looking at these old bound magazines. Because you can, you know, at one point you're reading... I mean, the very first one I opened had a long argument about the plot of Last Year at Marienbad. Huh. And then by the time I got to the most recent ones, I would turn the page from the poll and it would be a review of Austin Powers and Goldmember or something. I'm not saying it's societal decline, but it's like you could watch the 20th century pass. And because it's nice, glossy stock, magazines hold up well.
Yeah, well, and it was like oversized, right? Bigger than a...
Big, square-bound... Yeah. And these appear to have been like bound by some institution. I don't know if it was UW or elsewhere, right after they came out. So they weren't all beat up like old books are, and they weren't yellowed like old newspapers were. Like, I felt like some movie nerd in 1958 reading about what Bergman movie might open in my country next.
Fortunately, no one but you has checked those out.
And no one has ever read them.
in 42 years.
The funny thing is, as we'll see, some of them are now collector's items, and I was like... I could just slip this into my pants and watch. Oh, should these even be here?
That's not a Ken Jennings thing.
Well, I didn't do it, but I'm now suggesting it to thousands of people less ethical than myself.
Steal from your local libraries.
Libraries have had a huge problem with people just, you know, getting a rare book, ripping out the map, stuffing it into their pants, and then selling it to a dealer for $50,000.
Oh, believe me, I have a whole wall of stolen maps from Austrian atlases.
Not by you.
No. They were stolen by Austrian thieves. No, probably Hungarian and Slovak thieves.
Sold on the open market to you.
Yeah.
So this thing's just buried in the middle of the magazine. Again, as I say, after some navel-gazing about Marguerite Duras novels and Alain René movies. The response they get from critics are unanimously negative.
Oh, yeah.
What an awful, like, because they say the same thing, like, just the 10 movies that mean the most to you, you know? And so they get, how do I narrow it down to 10? Critics are legitimately telling them their counts. I've seen 5,777 movies, and you want me to narrow it down to this arbitrary number? How dare you, sir?
How dare you? I'm consulting this spiral-bound notebook I carry with me everywhere.
Yeah, that's the thing. Anybody who knows their number also probably has a ranking. So come on, sir.
Yeah.
Others, basically, you know, they in the issue, they list all the quotes. What an awful idea. What a thing to ask. This is a lousy and silly pursuit. This is impossible. This is barbarous. And this being Britain in 1952, goodness, how hard it was to whittle down. So it's,
I used the word barbarous yesterday, but I haven't used the word lousy in forever. When was the last time you called something lousy?
Oh, I love lousy. And I think it might just be...
It's a great word.
Neil Simon plays that I saw in the 80s. Well, I don't know what made me say lousy.
It has lice. That's how bad it is.
The old meaning of lousy was if something was teeming. Yeah. You would be like, this room is lousy with drunks.
Sure. I think I would use that more likely than to call something lousy.
To me, that was just crazy because I only had heard the... You know,
this is bad.
This is not quality.
No, what? I think maybe my older family members all said, like, this place is lousy with communists.
If you are someone who in 2023 still says things are lousy, meaning abundant, please let us know. They do not find that Potemkin is the best movie ever made.
Okay.
What's shocking about their list is it's extremely recent. This is 1952, and these critics are like, three of the top 10 are like from the last 5 to 10 years.
Man with the Golden Arm.
That's yet to come out, maybe. Isn't that 50? Oh, it might be. When did the movie come out? It's movies that do not get watched much anymore.
Isn't it 49?
Is that, I would have thought that was
Man with Gold. This is the type of,
let's do it in real time,
content that is Man with a Golden Gun.
The Nelson Algren novel comes out in, looks like the movie's 55.
Oh, 55.
Because if it's Sinatra, it's got to be after From Here to Eternity, which is 51 or so.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not great with dates, but often I can do the order like that. Like in the top 10 is like a very recent kind of pseudo documentary made by the Nanook of the North guy.
Okay.
Except this one's set in the bayous of Louisiana. David Lean's Brief Encounter, kind of a Hollywood weep. This is a British. So this is going to be the British film establishment, even though they do send ballots all over the world. The poll will have a British bias for many decades.
British bias in film or British bias in taste?
Both.
Because I could see they would be like, oh, we love American noir.
Yeah. There's definitely a thing where once the French critics start getting into it, then you see their tastes reflected in the French, the American and Japanese movies they like. But they like the British made, the pride of the British made art of Brief Encounter, a kind of a... Mm-hmm. A sad will-they-won't-they married romance. The winner is actually Ladri di Biciclette, Victoria De Sica's Bicycle Thieves.
Yes.
It's often called The Bicycle Thief in the U.S., but in Europe it was almost always Bicycle Thieves, which actually reflects a plot development from the third act of the movie. There are multiple thieves. Have you ever seen Vittorio De Sica's Italian neorealist classic Bicycle Thieves?
I don't think so, but then again, I don't know. Because it sounds very familiar, and
it's the kind of thing that works as high art because it's
right. It's
after the war. It's shot on location, unlike Hollywood movies. It deals in kind of a gritty way with poverty and deprivation.
The like war-torn poverty?
A lot of De Sica's and Rossellini's movies are made in war-torn Rome after the war. In this case, a poor man needs his bike for his new job of plastering posters.
Right.
The Jason Finn pursuit.
Sure.
And his bicycle is stolen. And so it's him and his young son wandering Rome, trying to follow leads that will get him his bike back.
Oh, I don't know.
It's basically Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yeah, sure.
But it also, in addition to being arty, it very much works on the audience level because it's a tearjerker about a cute kid and a stiff upper lip dad. So on a sentimental level, it really works. And I think maybe today's audience is actually, at the time, what seemed like a too gritty to be believed movie now probably seems like a
romantic fantasy.
Yeah, like a insufferably cute sentimental movie.
But it's in Italian?
It is.
And so there was already like a burgeoning Italian art film universe?
Yeah, and this would have happened in the 30s as well. The French were, you know, ahead of a lot of the, you know, the Hollywood and the UK film establishment on a lot of artistic axes. So they would have been used to seeing groundbreaking movies subtitled.
But they weren't bound by the Hays Code, so they could do sexier things, right? Was that always a part of it?
Yeah, I don't know how much that would have affected a film poll in 1952. That's interesting to think about. Because when you look at the list, it's not, you know, it doesn't yet reflect the directors like Bergman or Fellini who would have built an audience like that in the U.S.
Yeah.
The French and Italian and Scandinavian directors who, you know, whose movies were also a little bit saucy. These all seem to be very much, you know, you know, we're man of the people and Chaplin makes us happy, or, yeah, you know, sure, the muscular nature of this von Stroheim movie, or the close-ups in Passion of Joan of Arc. You know, it's just kind of a, you know, what are the artsiest things?
Anything with Burt Lancaster.
Citizen Kane does not make the top 12. It is tied for 13th.
Oh, tied with what?
Let me see. Renoir's Grand Illusion, a World War One era thing, and John Ford's Grapes of Wrath.
Interesting.
But the
sample, say Steamboat Willie.
The sample size is so small that, like, it's really whether a movie got 15 votes or 9 votes will make it either number 4 or number 14. You know, it's
wow.
And this continues in the future of the poll because they continue to, crucially, in 1962, some editor has, like, hey, it's been 10 years since we ran that little package, and a lot has happened in movies since then. The French New Wave has happened. A new up-and-coming group of critics have championed, as you say, noir and American Westerns and, you know, all these kind of old-fashioned musicals and literary adaptations. What French would have called the cinema of quality has kind of fallen off the critical map. What would this list look like today? Let's revisit our thing.
Did they still ask only 15 critics?
It's still a small group. Let me see. Are there numbers here? It seems to be about the same number of critics because the winning movie is in the low 20s and you need about 10 to get in the top 10. Mm. And it hasn't been shaken up that much. Citizen Kane has moved to the top. It's, you know, it was a newish movie then and now it's got 20 years of
history. What do you think changed in the culture that Citizen Kane in that 10 years or 15 years?
Well, let me ask you, what do you think of Citizen Kane when you watch it today? Are you one of these people who's like, overrated? I can't believe people talk about this movie.
No, but it's such a psychological film. It all happens in a room.
It seems very modern to me, just the framing thing of, like, you know, we're going to structure a movie like this by following a new lead character in every act and he'll have different flashbacks and...
Yeah.
That all seems like, you know, today you wouldn't think anything of it.
But I think what...
But in 1942...
I think the startling subject matter had to play...
Right. This is a real person we're tweaking.
Yeah.
And that's kind of lost to us today. Mm-hmm. Today, if you did a movie about a Trump-like blowhard, that would be what would lead all the discourse about it. Today, nobody really thinks that much about the real life menace of William Randolph Hearst when they talk about Kane.
Right.
It's just all about, oh, deep focus photography. He put ceilings on the sets. You know, it's more about the Wells, the wizard, Wells, the technician. But at this point, critics love Wells. You know, if there's one thing that the French New Wave guys agree on, it's that, like, Wells was a boy genius. And
Wells also agreed.
Yeah, Wells would be the first. And that everybody else is an idiot. I love. Do you love watching 70s and 80s clips of Orson Welles saying that Woody Allen is a terrible little man?
Yeah, what was the... What
the
was
worst the, kind of human. Charlie the, Chaplin was quite dumb when you think about it.
He did one the other day. Oh, it was...
He did?
No, yeah, he didn't.
Big if true.
But it was... what was it? What was I... I was down some rabbit hole. It's not that this went around. It's that I've ended up in some dark room where Kazan... I found myself... reading up on him and then watched Wells denounce him when he was getting all his honorary Oscars late in life and people were either standing and applauding or sitting with their arms folded in
Nick Nolte sat.
Yeah, in 1985 Oscar ceremonies and Wells is like, garbage. Traitor.
Mostly it is kind of frozen in the silence. It's most of the same movies that you would have seen on the list 10 years ago, maybe because they're asking enough of a mix of old and new critics that unless it's something like Citizen Kane that everybody can get together on, nobody has the votes.
How do they feel about the big epics, which would have been coming out at that point?
The silent epics seem to be kind of falling off the list. There's no more Griffith anymore. It's got to be something like Eisenstein where it's a, you know, it's a technician at work there's definitely a mind at work and in this case, a left-leaning, political mind at work.
Right. Right. But Lawrence of Arabia isn't like,
I mean, Lawrence of Arabia came out that year and there are a couple recent movies, you know, it's not just the French New Wave. We've also discovered that Japan is making good movies. India's making movies. So there's a Mizoguchi movie on the list. Satyajit Ray, you know, the Indian, you know, Pather Pachali is almost makes the top 10. His, the first in Ray's Apu trilogy of kind of, you know, kind of honest autobiographical Indian films. La Ventura, an Antonioni kind of avant-garde art movie where a woman disappears and is never found and people kind of alienated people stare at each other sadly, is the number two movie and comes within two votes of passing Citizen Kane.
Huh.
And so this is a movie that would have just come out a few years before. You know, there's enough people who are like, even though this is new, we're convinced this is the future. So the early lists have some new movies, or, you know, at least there's one here.
I mean, this is kind of what made me suspicious of these lists when I first encountered them. What, in the 80s, where it felt like, really, the Battle of Algiers is the greatest movie of all time? Like, I feel like, well, you've got some ideology pushing this.
That's true. And then some of them you watch and it's been a few decades and maybe they actually don't hold up, you know? Yeah. We were wrong on some deep level to think that Chaplin was funnier than Keaton or you know, just that the times changed.
Yeah.
The styles changed. This list, and somebody in the article actually refers to this, one of the people who write, they print every critic's list, which is fun.
Oh, that's fun.
And somebody says, this is every critic's favorite parlor game. So by 1962, this is established as, we know that when critics get together, boy, are they playing the high fidelity, tell me your top five, top 10 game.
One more reason not to go to that party.
The thing is run in 1972. Again, the list with Citizen Kane on top of it basically stays frozen for the rest of the 20th century until I first discovered it in the mid to late 90s. I had a kind of a film nerd friend who worked at the university library who was like, you know, you can come in and just watch any of our laser discs. And so I came in and started working my way through the Criterion collection.
Nothing more fun than watching a film in a chair in the library.
In a carrel in the library. Well, think about this. Like, we're into the home video age, but there's nowhere I can see these movies.
Right, of course. You know,
like, if I was in Seattle, I could have gone to Scarecrow and I could have rented these on VHS tape. But the nerds all had Laserdisc because it looked a little better.
Yep. And you could watch Potemkin.
And I was in Utah.
Although
and
there now was, you own it.
And there was no, I do. But there was no other way to, you know, even if I wanted to watch some big international hit that was 50 years old, I couldn't watch Seven Samurai any other way than to go put in the Laserdisc and flip it,
of course,
eight times. And I found the Sight and Sound list, and it had basically stayed frozen with Citizen Kane at the top and then Renoir's Rules of the Game. And the 92 list basically was the 62.
Whoa,
list.
Interesting.
And the university library had the Sight and Sound issue, and so I checked it out, and they were still only listing, it was still not yet a cover package. Like the 1992 list, it's like Tim Roth talks about Reservoir Dogs is on the cover. And then they're also like, and Our Pole. It would be like as if the first 50 years of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, they were just like, you know, it was mostly interviewing a jockey or a gymnast or something. And then they're like, oh, and we also have bikinis in the back.
How much of that became just like, well, you have to say, these are the top movies because otherwise you look like a dope, and there'd been no disruptor, nobody with long sideburns.
Right. Like you don't, they're going to print your list. So,
yeah.
So some people,
why not say Macmillan and Wife?
And some people do produce a kind of idiosyncratic list because they think that's fun, but it's shocking how many people, critics and directors alike, because in 92, they start a director's poll. Will just be like, here are my favorite movies in order. And it's basically the top 10.
Right.
Citizen Kane, Seven Samurai, like they kind of feel like, I mean, honestly, it's just because of how art affects you when you're young, right? Like it becomes, it's the first movies you saw that kind of froze your idea of what a great movie is. And these guys were reacting to the critical consensus when they were coming up in 62. And so in 92, their list is unchanged. And it's, they're not bad, but it's Citizen Kane, Wizard of Oz, Seven Samurai, Wild
Strawberries. What's your favorite Cure record?
Mine?
Yeah.
I don't know. Disintegration?
Yeah, correct.
I mean, it's...
Moving on.
And it's the same thing, right? It's it's like, when did you discover it?
Yeah, right.
Everything, even if you discover... I found that even bands I discovered at the sellout time, I prefer the later sellout records.
Interesting.
I prefer Doolittle by the Pixies to Surfer Rosa or Caribou, you know?
Fascinating.
I prefer...
You would get beat up at certain house parties.
I prefer Document and Green and Out of Time to Murmur and Recon... I know.
I'm going to drag you.
But it's just because, you know, where you find it.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Sure.
And okay, there's definitely a big effect like that with movies. And
so when that became all Gen X critics, was it suddenly like, Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Well, that's what happens. So, you know, there's small increments throughout the 20th century. You know, in the 60s, we discover Keaton, and suddenly Keaton's like boyoying in the 72 list.
Because he was just neglected all that time because Chaplin took up all the oxygen?
I think it was thought that, you know, Chaplin was had the heart.
Oh.
And Keaton was just the guy that did the well-constructed mechanical gags. And as the world changed and we were like, it's actually really mawkish when Chaplin sees the blind girl, whereas...
Keaton has so much to say.
If a house falls on you, like, that's universal. I mean, it really shows that critics are heartless monsters, basically, that they're like, I'd rather watch a house fall on a dude than a blind lady fall in love with a dude, you know?
Well, anything's, there's nothing worse than corny.
Exactly.
And that starts happening at some point. It's all these people that make that true.
At some point, and it's self-perpetuating. All their friends are telling them Chaplin's corny and Hitchcock's not anymore. Before, Hitchcock was corny and at some point, somebody's going to influentially argue, actually, no.
Mm.
Here's why Chaplin's super relevant to our age. And, you know, if the world hasn't ended, maybe it swings back. You know, the 72 list is where you get some Bergman and Fellini movies. But they start to fall out, actually. 82, there's hardly, you know, the newest films in the top 10 are like Seven Samurai and Singin' in the Rain. Like, Revival House, your parents' movies are the newest movies on the list. Although there has been a reappraisal of Hitchcock. I think Donald Spoto's book has maybe come out, so we now think of him as a dark genius who's not just making slick genre movies. He's actually some kind of crazy outsider artist. And as Truffaut notes, the 1982 list is kind of the last one where we're just going to be going on memory. Like, Truffaut offers some quote that's like, you know, in the same way that the canon of literature was changed by people having a shelf full of books, for the first time in the movies, we're not just going to be going on our childhood memories. We're actually going to have a shelf full of movies, and that's going to change everything. And it doesn't happen immediately. You know, 1992, the top 10 list still has no 60s movies on it.
Bizarre.
It's a bigger group. It's like 145 critics. They're mostly amenable now. Nobody's complaining. The directors, when they had a director's poll, it's the directors who are like, this is bullshit. You know, Elia Kazan won't do it. Gus Van Sant won't do it. Godard won't do it. This is not a respectable pursuit for an artist like myself.
They won't
submit a list.
Contribute. Yeah. Oh, of course not. It's not a sport.
In the 1992 list, they're still just listing a top 10. So they have all this data. And I went back and I found the 92 issue and I went through the lists director by director and critic by critic and kept a tally. I produced my own top 100 on my computer.
Boy, you're really dispelling those rumors that you're a mega nerd.
A lot of people think I'm some kind of weird, you know, fixated wonk or geek.
No.
But I was doing totally normal stuff like hand counting sight and sound ballots.
Recently.
In the mid-90s. Because they were not producing the top 100, you know, like... the culture was not yet like, you've got all this data, let's dig into it. Whereas that did change over the years. In 70s and 80s polls, there's some note that like, hey, you know, Raymond Williams and Edward Said are telling us our canon is too male and white. So take a look at this. We got a few Japanese directors, you know,
right.
92 is the first time where they're like, wow, there are really no women in this list. No women. No women directors. And it's really because women did not have the chance to direct. A movie by a Belgian director named Chantal Ackerman, kind of an avant-garde quasi-documentarian, the kind of director whose movies might be 8 minutes long or might be 4 hours long. You'd be more likely to see them playing by night in a museum or an art gallery than in an art house. You know, the kind of art film I'm talking about where it's
yes.
Not even distributed.
I do.
Like when normal people say art film, they mean like, depending on who they are, they might mean Life is Beautiful with Roberto Benigni.
Or the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas this is like, no, theaters won't show this. You had to go to a museum for a week when it was showing. she had a movie called John Dielman that actually got some votes, which leads the whoever's writing the cover package, or it's not a cover package, whoever's writing the introduction to sniff, well, certain films certainly must matter to a generation. The implication being, yeah, there were sure some young feminists this time, and they picked this Chantal Ackerman movie, kind of 3 or 4 hours about the drudgery of a Belgian housewife.
Right. Mary Wollstonecraft, right up there in the canon.
Exactly. And there's one. It's, you know, there's a couple token directors. There's one Claire Denis movie. Maybe there's one Maya Deren movie. In 2002, for the first time, there is a cover package. Sight and Sound has realized this is the draw. Like,
this is why people buy this
It's
episode.
Been 10 years, and now here's the new poll. Because the culture had been coming around to this. Like, it's all now about top 10 lists. And these guys have the only one that goes back to 1952. It's still a bunch. There's still two silent movies in the top 10, but like you can see at least some reappraisal movies are like the new movies in the top 10 in 2002 are Vertigo.
Okay.
Which has now had its restoration and a new audience has seen it. And it's by this time I have seen the Robert Harris restoration and I'm like, oh, I was wrong about this on VHS. This movie's fantastic.
And is that the only, or is it the highest ranking Hitchcock?
It is. And 2001 A Space Odyssey. These are the new movies in 2002. Weirdly, Godfather and Godfather Part II have been considered as one movie for some reason. False. And they're doing, I know.
I object.
And they're doing very well.
Oh, wait, are they talking about the one where they were combined for television? No.
They are not talking about the CBS one. What was that, the Godfather saga?
Yeah.
In chronological
order? I watched it on TV when it came out.
Well, it has scenes that aren't in either of the first two movies. It has some scenes that were cut out from both of the theatrical cuts.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. But you can see those scenes on video now, so. Weirdly, The Godfather does very well in the director's poll, but not in the critics' poll. Nobody thinks Coppola is like a top whatever director. But
this is what year?
2002.
You're kidding me.
It's 2002, and the discussion is still Vertigo and 2001 are the hot up and comers.
Wow.
They are.
But there's no Apocalypse Now. There's no.
Let me see. Is it this year or the next year? In one of these years, Apocalypse Now is the most. Well, that takes us to 2012. 2002 is up to 145 critics, and there's for the first time, there's a bunch of hand-wringing that, wow, this is a lot of white males. Like,
right.
Maybe it's not just that there is a canon, it's selective, but like, what if our selectivity biases are like actually kind of detrimental?
Wait a minute.
To the world as a whole.
Maybe we're the baddies.
It's definitely, for the first time, there's a what if we're the baddies. Whereas in 1992, the poll is like, yeah, some young feminists liked Chantal Ackerman, I guess, if that's what you're into. Whereas in 2002, it's very much like, could this be some self-perpetuating thing about white directors?
Did you hear there's a black film director?
Exactly.
Come on.
But not on this list, there is not,
right.
By the way. And even in 2012, it's still incredibly white. You have to go all the way down to number 14 to get a movie from the 70s, which is Apocalypse Now. You have to go down to the mid-20s even to get a movie from the 21st century, even though they're kind of by this, I guess there's enough old critics in the poll that even though Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love or David Lynch's Mulholland Drive are just unquestionably now top of the canon movies.
With a bullet.
They're still number 25 with a bullet, you know? Yeah. Vertigo, in a big surprise, is now, for the first time since 1952, there's a new number one. Vertigo noses ahead of Citizen Kane.
Wow.
And the media has started to report on the poll as a horse race. In the weeks leading up to it, will it be Kane again or will there be an upset? You can treat anything as a horse race, not just... It turns out you can ruin anything this way, not just electoral politics. For the first time, they're not sending out handwritten letters. They're doing it digitally. They're including online critics. And because it's digital, they can reach out to 1,000 people. They get 846 responses back.
And Vertigo
is the best movie of all time. Have you seen it? What do you think about Vertigo?
I have seen it. It's fine.
It's fine.
I mean, it's good.
It tends to be divisive. Vertigo tends to be like, this movie doesn't work. The third act is crazy.
I mean, I like a crazy third act, but
I just liked kind of the dreamlike, the stuff that some people hate, the driving silently through San Francisco with the Bernard Herrmann music playing, the implication that maybe she is kind of a ghost. Then it turns out the ghost is in his head and it's his problem.
Call is coming from inside the house.
The feminist reading of like kind of how awful Jimmy Stewart, you know, America's sweetheart is actually just a sicko in this movie.
I'm a Kim Novak stan, so.
But she looks weird in the third act with the wig and the dark hair. And
yeah, but you know, doesn't mean you don't want to see her in a wig and dark hair.
it had, by the time Vertigo, like, I kind of felt like I had already been like, whoa, like, this is Vertigo and 2001 really are the movies that, like, kind of woke me up. And,
oh, wow. Okay.
And suddenly they're taking the pull by storm. And I felt like, ah, my opinions have been, and it's just because there were more people of my generation in the poll.
But
and,
you as a 20, oh no, I guess you were 30.
I would have been like, when I'm like getting my mind blown by Vertigo in 2001 and Michael Powell's movies, you know, basically the movies I saw on the 92 Sight and Sound poll, I'm a mid 20 year old.
So you're a 25 year old and you're not like Reservoir Dogs. You're planting your flag at Vertigo.
And I wonder why. You know, at some level, it is kind of the back padding of, hey, I've seen the great works, capital G, capital W.
Right.
But, you know, when I saw Pulp Fiction, it was the same thing. I couldn't get enough of it, and I watched it 10 times. But it really was like, it's because, like, this movie seems to have the stature that I associate with.
Right.
With these all-time greats that I've been watching in kind of a homeworky way.
But no one ever says Dr. Zhivago, right? It's always that bloated 60s stuff never...
Lawrence of Arabia did very well with the directors for a while. And because it's a British poll, those David Lean movies kind of do disproportionately well. Right. But yeah, these kind of bloated 60s, they're the first things to go. Like, I think even in their time, a bunch of critics were like, oh no, you know, do not go see it Around the World in 80 Days.
Yeah, but you and I were just talking yesterday about like how we're going to conspire to help you buy the Cinerama. And the Cinerama was made to show those, like...
It's got the curved screen that was fashionable for 18 months.
Yeah, Vertigo is going to look like Ding Dong on that.
And all the decisions that went into making those movies were motivated by how do we get people to come to not watch TV, but to come to a movie. They got to be wide, they got to be colorful, they got to be long, they got to be an event. You know, maybe they're a road show, they've got an overture, it's like the theater, it's... Yeah. Maybe you dress up, maybe you bring your neighbors.
Smellotron,
3D, all that kind of stuff. So that brings us, finally, this is probably a pretty long show. Oh, and there are some women in the top 100 for the first time in 2012. Like, I think...
Catherine Bigelow? No, too early.
Too early. It's a French director named Claire Denis, whose works are beloved. This 1940s surrealist named Maya Deren, who... you know, hung out with Man Ray and made these little kind of short feminist movies. And again, Chantal Ackerman. In 2022, the world has changed. This is like an epical event for film nerds who now can all hang out with each other on film Twitter and on Letterboxd. You know, this is no longer happening in a city level film critic circles. These conversations are now happening online, which means they're public, which means anybody can get into the discourse, smart or dumb, old or young.
There's not an internet yet, right? There is, but there's not one that's...
Well,
I guess it's in exactly these people.
In 2012, for the first time, they're finding these online-only reviewers and saying, yeah, we'll send you an invite through email. But 2022 is fully, you know, list came out in December. So this is a borderline current event show, which is why I almost didn't do it. But
but weirdly, not for Gen Z.
Yeah, exactly. For all the Gen Z Sight and Sound subscribers.
They can't afford it, Ken. They can't afford your boomer movie magazine.
Well, the cover price is probably £12, even though the BFI is subsidizing it. This was a massive event in film Twitter world, you know, and it bubbled out to headlines, you know, like... Because it's every 10 years. Every 10 years, the landscape of film criticism changes. Coming in at the end of 2022, the BFI has announced that the Sight and Sound Critics and Directors poll will return. And this time, it's fully, the culture has caught up with it. It's a big cover package, four different covers, so collectors can get them all. Instructions about you better mail order in advance because these are going to run out. And they do, by the way. They're selling for $185 on eBay within weeks.
Hate. I hate everything about that.
The headline says, the votes are in. But you can choose. Do you want the Kane cover? Do you want the 2001 cover? Do you want the...
Michael Kane?
Citizen Kane. His brother, Citizen.
Kane Mutiny?
No. That's Charles Foster Kane. There is a man. A certain man. This time they've reached out. There's been a massive push to broaden the demographic. This time, you know, last time it was big news that when it went from 145 to 846. This year it's doubled. You know, they reach out to
1,600 critics,
thousands of people, and they get 1,639 critics' votes back, 500 directors' vote. And it's not just that, but there's specifically language saying we'd like to platform to a wider range of voters.
Right.
So there definitely is some consideration to why
diversity and inclusion.
Yeah, why has nobody in the continent of Africa ever gotten one of these? Why is it still like 88% male critics? So you
the Battle of Algiers, back at the top.
Pontecorvo. So the modern idea that these numbers do not look like the world is very much top of mind. And I haven't seen a gender breakdown of the results.
So is Black Panther the number one movie of all time?
The number one movie is a surprise. And it leads to headlines even outside the world. As soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, this is going to be so many bad think pieces about this. And sure enough, there was.
Was it The Devil Inside Miss Jones?
It is the over 3-hour Chantal Ackerman feminist drudgery masterpiece of the 70s. Jean Dielman, what's it called? It's her address. Jean Dielman, 23 Rue de Commerce, or Quai de Commerce, 1080 Bruxelles. You know, it's her address in Brussels.
Right. Rolls right off the tongue.
It's a 3-hour movie with a 3-hour title that no one has ever seen.
The best movie of all time, as voted by 1,600 critics.
And it has just topped Citizen Kane in 2001 and Vertigo and all the rest as the best movie of all time. And for the first time, this is a massive multimedia splash for this. You know, the next day, the Criterion Channel says, hey, we've got 56 of the top 100 movies. Watch them here. They're revealed in the magazine in countdown form. I think in 2012 was the first time where they actually listed a top 100. Like, look, we have all this data. People are going to... Ken is at home typing this into his spreadsheet anyway. Let's put out a top 100. But this time it's actually a countdown. So it's like, in the number 98 spot, Get Out, 97. And it comes all the way down to, and suddenly Citizen Kane and Vertigo are runners up to this kind of 3-hour feminist gallery piece, basically. And they're showing the BFI South Bank does a series. You can go to the BFI theater and watch all 100 in order. This is a big cultural event and it gets all these headlines because this feminist movie is the top pick.
And did you immediately watch it?
I had just seen it, weirdly. Mindy and I had watched it maybe 6 months before.
And what pushed you to watch it at the time?
The same reason I watch a lot of this stuff. There's some kind of...
Did you know it was nominated? I guess it's not nominated, right? This is all just coming out of thin air.
This comes out of nowhere. Like, and this was a movie that literally came out of thin air. It was like in the 30th spot a mere decade before. And it had been reassessed. Well, let me discuss this in a second. But I think one of the reasons why these lists appeal is because there's a certain kind of anal retentive mind that likes working through these things methodically. Like, now I've got a new list of movies to see. And I had seen this in the top 100 in 2012, and I was like, oh, how have I never seen this? There were a number of African directors and women directors for the first time. So I'm watching a Senegalese movie called Tuki Buki that I'd never seen, which is great. And this movie, I understood, but you really do kind of watch this movie, this woman make beds for 10 minutes, and then she makes lamb chops for half an hour. And it's not quite as... what's the name for those gray British movies of the 60s? It's not just quite as mundane as that. We learn that she's got her son's curious about sexuality, but she likes to avoid the topic, but she's also paying for the rent with a weekly client who she sleeps with.
Oh, so it's not...
It's not plotless.
It's not Dada, like, I'm going to make a 2-hour movie about a woman making beds.
But it might as well be for big chunks, because even though you've learned, oh, wow, she's paying the rent by sleeping with that guy every Tuesday, then it's like, all right, back to her breading the cutlets, but there is something hypnotic about watching the drudgery. And of course, that's the easy feminist angle is like, a huge audience and a largely male audience has turned a male gaze on women in many ways, but like, never to the just the dreariness of making dinner for your ungrateful kid.
Yeah, watch us iron the sheets for 2 hours.
Yeah, like what if there, what if you had to consider the ironing? And, Ackerman made this in the 70s when this kind of thing was a little more revolutionary, consider the free labor here, right. Men. But that's not why. And the funny thing is, when I talked to Mindy about this, she actually, I think it really spoke to her on a much deeper level. Like, I was like, oh, I totally get like why this movie works. And she was like, this is one of the like best movies I've seen in a while, even though it's very slow and 3 hours long.
When you guys watch movies together, do you turn up the lights at the end and
make out?
Well, I know you're making out through the whole film, but do you discuss, or do you discuss the next day over breakfast?
I feel like it might be like the next time we're like in a car or something, you know, because you don't want, like, after the movie, you don't want to be like, all right, now let's have a book club, right?
Well, I filled 4 pages in my book, my notebook. Exactly. How many pages did you fill?
Here are my takes. So Ackerman has been played at a recent film, you know, a recent film festival, kind of a landmark thing in London, kind of did rediscover her whole oeuvre. And it's very relevant to the times. And we're living in an era when you can watch a 3-hour movie on streaming or video. So you could pause it, you know, like a lot of these long form, slow core movies, Bellatar and stuff have done much better in recent years, given that you don't have to make a day-long commitment to the theater. If you want to watch 9 hours of Shoah or 11 hours of Berlin Alexanderplatz, you know, you can watch it at home, and suddenly it's more accessible. But the main reason, and a bunch of dumb think pieces were written about, you know, the wokeism that's pretending that,
sure,
that this movie has taken over. And it was everywhere on the list, by the way. You know, the Claire Denis movie that kind of was a consensus top 100 movie is now in the top 10. And this Iranian, you can almost go through the list and be like, wow, this is new discourse. I bet it's directed by, yep, a woman, you know, or an Iranian guy or a Senegalese guy, or you know, you could kind of see, you know, either what were the factors that inflated it this time, or maybe what were the factors that have been keeping it down for decades.
Right. Depending on whose tweet thread you're reading.
Exactly.
And Chantal Ackerman, although a Belgian film director, teaches film at City College of New York. She's not like living in a community in some arrondissement.
She passed away in 2015, but yes, Belgian born, but yeah, was she a New York resident much of her life? She died in Paris. A suicide. I didn't know that.
Oh dear.
Well, I mean, so like the depression, you know, the female lens on depression that's apparent in much of her work, I guess, was autobiographical.
Well, and her parents were Holocaust survivors.
Oh, right.
A lot going on there.
But the real reason that this movie surpassed Kane or Vertigo or whatever, I think, was commented on too little, when most of the discourse was like, is the Academy out of, you know, is the Critics Academy out of control? The real reason is people are submitting a list of 10 movies, and it's going to be public. And there's a sense that when you put together, I was going to ask you this, when you put together these lists, which you apparently hate to do, like, do you make it as a whole? Or are you like, well, let me just tick down and I'll do 1 to 10? Or are you like, boy, I don't have a comedy?
No, I think it depends on the person. And I think a lot of people that really take those lists seriously put them together like an album.
Exactly.
Where they're like, you cannot.
It's a mixtape. You're curating.
Yeah. You cannot appreciate my number 5 choice without understanding my number 6 and number 4 choices.
And if you look at these 70s or 80s lists, it's clear that there is definitely, I should have a Japanese director here.
Yeah, right.
And there is, you know, everybody will put in Seven Samurai or Ugetsu or something. And this is just never extended to like, oh, wait, women direct movies too.
Right. And people from other countries.
Right.
Including the country of Africa.
And yeah, exactly. And so suddenly the visibility is, ooh, I do not have a single black director on my list.
Right.
And it's not just that, like,
Scan.
It's not necessarily the performative social justice thing that would be complained about. And it's not even representation matters. It's really more like, I want this to represent the breadth of my taste.
Yeah, an earnest attempt to do what we're all trying to do, which is open the doors.
Yeah. But it doesn't even have to be an act of activism. It's just more like, if this list is all white men, I don't just watch movies by white men. Like, ooh, I should make sure my list reflects that in some way.
But the criticism is that none of these people want their list to reflect poorly on them.
Right.
Because there's always going to be somebody that's like, I looked at your list.
I mean, that could happen, you know. You really have to not, you know, you have to be really not care. You have to be Woody Allen, basically, to be like, nope, this year I'm still submitting Rules of the Game, Wild Strawberries, you know. Live with it.
But there's a way that you could look at any list like that and level any number of criticisms. All these directors were between the ages of 45 and 52, and so this is an ageist list.
And there is a procedural issue that when you try to say, well, I'm going to make sure that my list is not all white men this time, because of the past inequities, there's a smaller list to choose from when you come to what are the truly great movies directed by an African director, or what are the truly great movies directed by a woman, just because they got so few opportunities. And what that means is your list of your, you know, let's say you have your eight white males and then your the two where you're more concerned about representation. Your eight white males, you're picking from a universe of tens of thousands of movies, which, you know, disadvantages your Hitchcocks and your Wellses because, you know, you're picking from a big universe. Whereas if I want to make sure that this list is not all white men, like, I've only seen, you know, the West has only seen maybe a dozen African movies, you know?
Right.
How many stone cold classics by women have there really been? None. And that's the problem. So it means that when you pick your female director or whatever it is, if you're somebody who does that, it just concentrates those votes. So the men are splitting the votes 100 ways. Your woman is probably going to be Ackerman, Darren, Claire Denis. You know, it's just a much shorter list.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we saw this in the early 90s when Maya Angelou was on every curricula.
Yeah.
You know, every lit curricula, where that was new, but there are other women of color who have written books.
And there were, you know, it's not to say that there weren't, but, it definitely gives the impression of tokenism if you're, if the critical discourse just surrounds the single most elite representatives of their demographics.
That's what's been wonderful about watching that evolution, where reading lists now are like extraordinarily diverse and have brought forward all these books that were there, but were not on the University of Washington freshman reading list
10 or 20 years ago.
20 to 30 years ago when I was there.
When I looked at I think yesterday, Sight and Sound expanded their top 100 to their top 250. Like, they were planning to have every critic and director's individual list on their website by January. It turned out to be a mammoth undertaking, and they're now saying mid-March, I think.
Do they keep expanding it because they need Vertigo to stay on the list? And it's
no, the math is not changing, but it's like, we announced numbers 1 through 100, but there's some cool surprises here. Right. Like Twin Peaks, The Return, that Showtime series, is like got enough votes to be a number 145.
No.
Even though it's not a movie by any definition, you know?
Wow.
And you know, that's just how the numbers worked out. They never say we're going to disqualify short films, we're going to disqualify document, you know, they kind of let people define movies themselves. And so I was going through that list, and there's a lot of, because of this inflationary effect on certain identities, you know, the African director you've never heard of, the black woman you've never heard of, you know, a lot of movies would just appear and I'd be like, this Iranian reclusive poet who made one movie, I have never heard of her. How am I going to get my hands on this? And it just, I had this amazing flashback to seeing my first Sight and Sound list in the 90s, and just, you know, the doors that open when you see just people talking and arguing enthusiastically. Most people didn't have that in their social circles, right. But you could have, and before the internet, you could have it in this magazine, and you'd be like, wow, the critics are talking about this Czech director I've never heard of. Finland, there's movies out of Finland now. The new guys in the 90s are Taiwanese, and I've never seen any of these. Like, it's almost like discovering a new level in a video game or something, where you're like, this is going to be hours of adventure. And I really kind of am in favor of this criticism by list, even though it's stupid in so many ways, just because this kind of becomes the venue where so much movie enthusiasm and discovery now happens. Like, it's more a magazine poll than any film festival or retrospective or conversation anywhere.
Yeah, it's curious, because when I Googled, I started to put in, talk about being good at Googling, I wanted to see where certain movies showed up in the Sight and Sound poll, and so I put various movie titles, with Sight and Sound to see where they came up, and no matter what movie I put in there, the top five results were all is the Sight and Sound poll too woke?
Yeah.
And then 100 Reddit like posts that are super long, and you realize, oh, it's a whole universe of people over on Reddit. I mean, absolutely, like, actually-ing each other to death.
And this is now synonymous with the critics poll. Like, one thing you see when you send out 2,000 ballots to critics online and off, because print media has died, is there's now no difference between the critics poll and just the daily discourse on film Twitter and Letterboxd and these other sites.
Right.
So it's a parallel universe that we don't live in, but now film nerds and critics all live there full time.
And I wonder how long before your list is like reflexively, as a director or whatever, your list of films is in itself an ironic commentary on
lists
making. And film and yeah.
Oh, you're totally going to have some anti-woke maverick
doing
malicious compliance. The same way this guy at UW recently did a ironic land acknowledgement and got yelled at by the faculty.
Yeah, he thought he was really funny.
He thought he was being hilarious. Yeah, how long till people start doing that?
Well, I, for one, welcome our new film critic overlords.
If everyone's a film critic, I guess nobody is, but I don't know.
I'm really hoping, I'm dreaming of that day.
2032 poll, we'll see.
And that concludes the Sight and Sound poll. Entry 1158.DE0413. Certificate number 51403 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram archive everything we've ever thought or said at Omnibus Project, or rather at Omnibus Project. Our handles were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
Just add an at when in doubt.
You can communicate with other futurelings by typing the word futurelings into your computer and see what happens. That's all you need to do to communicate with them. You can then communicate with them just by thinking and singing aloud to yourself in the shower.
Is that right?
They'll know you're there. You can mail us actual mail at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. And we encourage you to support the production of the show by going to patreon.com/omnibusproject and pledging a nominal amount. It would, by definition, be nominal.
Because you could name it.
And that's right. And it's also...
You can name $120 if you want to give that every week.
You should. You should give us $50,000 to not produce the show.
Oh, that's true. Should we start taking... should we have a competing Patreon and to not produce the show? And if it ever exceeds the other one, the show will end?
$50,000 a month and we will quit making Omnibus. So go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and click... and enter the promo code Omnibus Project. And then pledge $20 a month, and you will be...
You get a tote bag.
On our list of favorite people.
Is that all you get? We'll make a top 10 list of listeners, and we'll read it at the end of every show.
Yeah.
Top 10 listeners.
Top 10 best listeners. It'll change all the time.
People will be like, oh, I'm not number two again. I hope I'm number one. No, I wasn't.
The thing is, we're going to have to prorate it according to your class, race, gender, and... productivity.
Like the fair you were talking about where Romanians had to pay a certain price funnel cakes, but Germans had to pay 10 times as much.
Yeah, or 100 times as much.
That's only fair.
You should punish the Germans. They like it.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. Will there be a Sight and Sound poll in 2032? Hard to say.
Almost certainly, unless the pocalypse.
We hope and pray that this pocalypse we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.